Welcome to the Halloween edition of the Life 2.0 podcast. I'm John St. Augustine. Time to go up the down staircase in the outdoor, make sense out of the senseless, and for this episode, see if I can't scare the shit out of you. Let's get to it. Glad to have you with me the day before Halloween, and full disclosure, this is always a highlight for me to do this show. You know, as long as I've been on radio, since 19, none of your damn business what year that was actually, but it was 1997, I always look forward to Halloween shows because it is a direct line back to my childhood days. My dad was the most incredible Halloween celebrator that I've ever known in my life. And what I mean by that is, ever since he was a kid, he would create these spook houses, as they were known back in the day, in his basement when he was just a little guy. And my grandmother endured all that stuff, and it is something he carried over into his adult life. So when we moved to this big house on Berto Avenue in 1967, it was a perfect setup for him to create the castle of his dreams. And I think a lot of this for my dad came from the fact that he was a kid of the 50s, 40s and 50s, but all the sci-fi stuff that was going on. You know, the movies were coming out, and of course he had Universal Monsters and all that kind of stuff, but he was just enraptured by this stuff. And he passed it down to me and my sister to a greater or lesser degree. But when he bought this house in 67, it was built in the 1800s, it was a Victorian house, and there was a basement with a rear entrance. And I clearly remember conversations with my mom and dad talking about it. Was one of the reasons he bought the house is I could build a haunted house in the basement. It's the perfect setup. You walk in the back door through the yard, and we can build all kind of mazes, and then you walk up through the house and you leave. Seriously, selling point for my dad was the ability to build a haunted house in the basement. How we live with our creature comforts and the proximity to the grammar school, that was all well and good. But it was really about how he could build a maze of horrors in the basement. So I think it was probably, you know, within a first couple, 3 years, once we got settled in there, my dad started going at it. And he would enlist the help of our family and friends and neighbors to pull all this off. And some of my greatest memories were just of coming home from Belding School, which was literally around the corner, you know, two blocks away from where I lived. And I would come walking out of school at the end of the day, sometimes at lunch, but mostly in the afternoon after school was over. I did my patrol boy stuff till like 3:30, whatever it was. And then I'd walk home. And when I got there, there was cars out in front of the house of my cousins, my cousin Rich and cousin Bobby and a couple other guys. And when I saw their cars there, I knew there was stuff going on in the basement, man. And I'd always walk in the back door to see what they'd been up to. And so the whole process was very cool. You know, my dad would probably in late August would start cleaning out the basement to get ready for October. And they would take everything out in the yard, you know, clean everything out. And my mom would serve sandwiches and, you know, lemonade. And these guys would have a beer now and again, what have you. And it was just this incredible process. So they'd pull it all out, and my dad would map out what the maze was going to look like that particular year. There were some structural things they had to work around, but for the most part, it was the same basic setup, and they always tried to add some new dimension of horror, if you might, follow along a line of a track where, you know, you only got so much space to work with, and so where you put the monsters and how it's all set up is always a big deal. And it was amazing to me the stuff that they'd come up with. Now, these are grown men, right? And some of the memories I have are just of how this thing was built. Underneath the back porch is where you would enter into the haunted house. And my dad built a ghost book stand. There was this black stand all shrouded with black crepe paper. And he put a skull on there that had like a little light in it with blood on its head. And there was a book there. And that book was where you would sign in. And I think, you know, he charged like a quarter or something to get in the place. You know, you have to understand this is long, long, long before these Halloween horror mazes now are big business. They make serious coin, scaring people. My dad was doing this stuff back for a quarter back in the day, and it was not uncommon to have a line. We lived on a corner right on the alley. It was not uncommon to have that line go out of the yard and all the way down to the other end of the block, a full city block, in the alley, people waiting to get in. And whether it was raining out or cold really didn't matter. Everybody knew that it was time to go to the haunted castle. And I actually have a framed copy of one of the flyers my dad would. Now listen, he's working on this stuff at the bank where he worked during, whether it was his lunch hour or not, I'm not sure, but he'd be drawing the mazes and creating all the flyers and stuff while he's at work. So I have one of those. It's very, very precious to me. And it reminds me of such a simple, wonderful, scary time back in the day. But when that was underneath the back porch, then walking in was the main door to the basement. And he had it kind of blocked off, so you know where the washer and dryer was. You can't get in there. And there was a little tool shed to the left. And there was always a ghoul in there, right? So there was like a little shelf there, like a tool bin kind of deal. And some ghoul would be in there, of course, in totally in the dark. As soon as you walk in the door, you get scared. You know, they scared the shit out of you. And there was another door that was put up right facing as you walked in. And I remember at some point, somebody found a old washing machine door with the glass in it. So they cut a hole in that door and they shoved that thing in there. And then they sprayed it with like WD-40 or put Vaseline on it to kind of, you know, smear. See, when you look through, you could kind of tell what was going on in there. And that room was the main attraction. That was Dr. Frankenstein's laboratory. And one of my dad's buddies, my Uncle Hal, you know, these are all uncles to me. Only a couple of them actually related by blood, but all these guys were uncles to me. And Uncle Hal had an amazing, he was like a draftsman or something, and he had amazing ability to draw and create images. And he created on cardboard, I wish I had kept some of this stuff, created on cardboard the whole lab, like in 3D, you know, the beakers and the books on the shelves. It was truly a work of art what this guy did. And then, of course, he would paint it in that fluorescent paint, and you put those black lights on, and it just jumped out at you. And in the early years, Dr. Frankenstein was my other uncle, Uncle Tom, who really wasn't an uncle, but we called him that. And he was the perfect Dr. Frankenstein. This guy was about 5'6". And about 4 foot wide and bald on top. And he had this kind of presence about him. Like he was a creepy guy. He was a great guy, but you could see how he could easily turn into a creeper. And so he got this wig on and, you know, the lab coat and the whole drill. And being 5'6" made whoever the monster was look twice as big. So it was a whole strategy there. And it was either Mr. Stitch from across the street, who was a fairly good-sized guy. He was probably 5'10", 5'11", but he looked huge next to Dr. Frankenstein, Uncle Tom. And then they started getting bigger. There's another uncle named Kenny, who was about 6'3", and about 260 pounds, and he really filled out the space. And later on in life was a guy that I played football with in high school, God rest his soul, Big Al Walschlager. And Al was all of 6'4", 6'5", at the time. And so we stuck him in there. And so you come into this room and you see all this stuff lit up. And here's this guy all sniveling and everything. And, you know, welcome to the haunted castle and all this stuff. And behind the curtain would be the monster. And I remember this big door that they put up. And they put these things called 7-Up light bulbs. I can't really describe except they're flickering lights. And when that switch was flipped up, those lights would go on and the monster would start shaking and everything. And like I said, in the early years, Mr. Stitch would do that or Uncle Kenny would do that. And when Big Al came along, we had a new Dr. Frankenstein. It was kind of like a shifting of the roster a little bit. So Tom did it in the early years with Mr. Stitch and Kenny. And when Al came along, we had my friend Jerry, who I went to high school with. And he was even creepier than Tom was. He just, it's amazing to me what happens when you put a lab coat on somebody and tell them to pretend they're Dr. Frankenstein. And so it was such a joy. They made it up every time. You know, there's no script here, except that you're supposed to scare the people when they walk in and make them, you know, feel creepy. And then you throw the switch and all of a sudden, you know, the monster's starting to come to life. And then the monster scares the people into the first section of the maze. And that Dr. Frankenstein stuff, again, I wish I would have kept some of the cardboard. It was truly, truly works of art that should be framed somewhere. So they send these people down to the maze, and it's you know, you zigzag in the basement, because the basement, quite frankly, was not that big. The zigzagging, the darkness, people huddled together like a bunch of yak with the shit being scared out of them, it made it seem like a mile long. So they go down that first hallway, and it's just, and they're just feeling their way down. At the end of the hallway, of course, is the second ghoul. The first one was in the tool bin. Then you got Dr. Frankenstein, and then you got Frankenstein, but then you head down the hallway. And at the end of that, that was a varying degrees of monsters. At one point, my Uncle Bob was dressed like a caveman. I mean, he really looked good. The whole, you know, looked like a really good caveman. He had like this fur on, and he had these boots on, and he had a beard and long hair. And at the end of that hallway, he stood there, and he had a switch on the wall that would flip on a red light or a blue light over him when the people got close. And he rigged up a rubber spider that was attached to an elastic band in the ceiling. And so when he yelled, "Rah!" the spider would fly out of his mouth at the people. And he had this club made out of paper mache, and he tried to get him. And so they would be herded to the next part. And there we had, again, various different types of weird things and creatures. And one time I remember clearly, we decided we're going to put a guy in a coffin. Now, the coffin was built. It wasn't a real one, so don't freak out there. But they built this coffin, and my buddy Al, who's about 5'7", he'd be the perfect size to fit in this thing. And he would lay there, and we put somehow under the rug, they put a step switch, means when people walked on it, it lit up. And so he had a mechanism in the coffin to pull a lever, and the lid would come up real slow. So one time, somebody tried to put a stake in his heart or something. He was laying there with this wooden stake, and somebody tried to jam it in, and I think that's when he quit. But it was a lot of fun to watch that. And then it wraps all the way around, and the final monster, man, the one that you really got to deal with, was the Wolf Man. And that was my cousin Rich, the Sarge. And I remember him coming back from his, you know, second tour of Vietnam, and his number one priority was to get down there to be the Wolf Man. It was so great. So what a get up this guy had. He had the ripped shirt and the whole thing, and, you know, the fake blood on his shirt. He wore a white shirt because it was fluorescent bulb. And he literally took the spirit gum like they did in Hollywood, and he would attach this like yak-like hair, this stage hair, to his face. And to get it off, it was like an hour to get this shit off his face. So he would be the last guy. He's this Wolf Man, right? And my dad, of course, would greet the people in the beginning and then scoot behind the scenes and then meet them again at the end and then try to protect the people from the Wolf Man. Back, back, he'd say. And at one point, my cousin had these chains made. They're plastic chains. You can buy them at the store, right? They're fake chains. But what he did is he cut the last link off, and he took wire coat hangers, and he wrapped them with electric tape so it looked like a chain link, but he was able to pull out of them. So he had them around his wrist like he was chained up. Rawr! And his people are screaming. My dad's like, "Back, back, you will not hurt these people," you know, all this stuff. And as soon as he pulled that one out of the chain, man, that was the end of that. People ran running up the stairs screaming for their lives. I remember Rich's wife, Marie, a few times dressed as like the gypsy woman to hold him back and things like that. And you have to understand, these guys took this stuff seriously. You're talking about doing this 4 or 5 hours a night for probably 2 weeks. It was the 2 weeks prior to Halloween. And the neighborhood couldn't wait. Every year, people, when's it going to happen? When's the dates? And it became quite a thing. And I think of all the things that my dad put his back into, that was probably those Halloween outings were the thing that were most important to him. It was just a huge transformation of this guy who was a button-down collar banker by day, couldn't wait for 2 weeks out of the year to become Dracula, basically. You know, he would vacillate between Bela Lugosi and Christopher Lee, who was the best. And so he kind of combined himself as both those characters. He did the Bela voice as best he could, but he looked more like Christopher Lee. My dad was not a big guy, but he was, you put a cape on a guy and bone white makeup and, you know, teeth, come on. So it was just an amazing thing for me as a kid to be involved with. So when Halloween rolls around every year, I get excited. You know, I don't do haunted houses like my dad did. Matter of fact, I had two roles really in the haunted house. One was when I was younger, probably up until about the age of 10, 12, 14, somewhere in there. My job was, I was the very last ghoul that you couldn't see on the top of the steps. I got wrapped in an oil cloth and I literally made my own masks. I mean, I really got into this stuff. I used to read the famous Monsters of Filmland magazine, man. And I learned how to make masks and stuff. So I'd get these clear plastic masks and I would drip wax on them or blood or all this other stuff. And so I'd be sitting there and they couldn't see me. So they think they've just escaped the Wolfman and they're heading towards safety. And of course, the top of steps in the dark, there I sit and I grab their legs and these kind of things. And then they run up into the house and my mom would give them some apple cider and send them out. And it was just quite the production. Then you say, everybody, all right, we got to reset everything. Send the next group in, literally 4 or 5 hours a night. They'd come out exhausted. And it was just the coolest thing to have as a kid in my life, to be part of all that, to watch all that. I remember before we opened the doors, we'd have to do a walkthrough, you know, just to make sure everything was working. You know, okay, here's this. And literally people would be waiting in line outside the door. We're getting ready. Okay, yeah, okay. Like 6:45, we'd open the doors. So at 6:30, I'd have to walk through just to make sure everybody was in their places and check it off and here's what we're going to do. And listen, to run into my dad in the dark under some red bulb with fangs in his face, full well knowing it's my dad, still gave me the creeps. I mean, it was that good. My mom could have been a Hollywood makeup artist. She did him right. When they got into this big time, when this became a thing, when it was almost like a Hollywood production to some degree, she had taken these black curtains. I don't know where she found them. And she had put them up in my room for a couple years because we lived facing the highway and there was a bright light out front, street light. So she did it to close off the room. But eventually those were replaced and she kept them. So she turned one of those curtains into a perfectly made Dracula cape. Working on the sewing machine, big collar sticking up and the bottom was, you know, like a bat wing and everything. Really cool. And, you know, my dad put the white shirt on and she would do this makeup on him where she would kind of get his widow's peak even more prominent and color his hair and slick it back. And, you know, he had a friend of his who was a dentist and made him real fangs out of some sort of mold and everything. I mean, this was serious shit back then. The only thing I never figured out to some degree was he on one of our trips to Appleton for vacation, he found this cross. I wish I knew where it was at. It was like a German flyer's cross, you know, something you'd see on a medal for the old German pilots back in World War I. And a matter of fact, it said 1914 on it, on his big heavy chain. And my dad bought that. You know, now Dracula is technically not supposed to wear a cross because it could be detrimental to his vampire health. But that just somehow pulled it all together. He'd come out walking down the stairs to get ready, and my sister about shit herself. It was so great. And we know this guy, and we love this guy, and yet he was basically, you know, Nosferatu. He was Dracula. It was so, so cool. So I get excited this time of year. You know, I have stuff out in front of the house. It's not nearly like what we used to do, but kind of in the honor and memory of my pop, I do that and light up a couple things, a couple ghouls and, you know, whatever. And I love horror movies. I'll sit and watch all month. You know, it's a thing for me. I remember when Creature Features first came on a WGN television, Channel 9 in Chicago. Even into my teens, I could remember being at my girlfriend's house as a junior and a senior in high school and saying, I got to go home. Why? Because me and my dad are going to watch The Wolfman for the 485th time. And to this day, when I sit down and watch those movies, kind of feel the old man next to me, nudging me. Remember this? It's just a feeling I get. It was something that was a bonding experience. It was something to pull us together. Everything from the schlocky 50s sci-fi stuff of The Day the Earth Stood Still all the way, as I mentioned, to the classics like, you know, Frankenstein, The Wolfman, and of course Dracula, all the Hammer films. And last year, I came across this website that has all these Hollywood-type masks that are basically replicas of the great Universal monsters. And one of my big creatures of all time was the creature from the Black Lagoon. I thought that was one of the best movies for what it was trying to accomplish. And the it was the, you know, this underwater guy and all that kind of stuff. I just watched it a couple days ago. And I remember when my son Andy was about probably around 15, 16, 17, somewhere in there. I remember him coming home from school. He wasn't feeling well. And all he wanted to do was sit with me and watch The Creature from the Black Lagoon. That meant I had done my job as a father. So to this day, when I catch it on television or I put the DVD in, I'll send him pictures. And when he was a little boy, he couldn't say Creature from the Black Lagoon. He'd call it Black and Lagoon. So I'll send him a Black and Lagoon picture, and we chuckle about it. So, but anyway, I found these masks, and I put down a couple of bucks to get a basic replica mask of the creature. It's sitting over here in my studio, and I've kind of held back on buying every single one of them because I got no room for them. But suffice to say, it has been a huge part of my life. And while Christmas is great and Thanksgiving is great, Halloween has this certain resonance to it. When I run into people that I knew from back then, one of the first things they talk about is, remember the Halloween parties and remember the haunted house and, you know, your dad and all this kind of stuff. And when my dad passed away in 2004, my sister and I knew it was a no-brainer to have him cremated with his Dracula cape on. I mean, it was perfect. And in my second book, Every Moment Matters, I actually have a chapter about my dad and how important Dracula and Star Trek was to him. There's his love, sci-fi, really, and horror movies. And the night before he passed away, it was an unbelievable experience. I was sitting in the side waiting room. He was in the main room, you know, going through the final stages of his life. And I was sitting there with him, and I turned the TV on. And what comes on but one of the Star Trek movies. I couldn't believe it because my dad was a huge Trek guy. He wasn't a Trekkie like going to any conventions, but he loved the show. And then right after that was one of the Dracula Hammer films, and I couldn't believe that they were back to back. It was an amazing thing, kind of appropriate, I guess, for his final journey. So that was my first job, was to scare people atop the steps. The second job I had was, there is an album out by Disney, I believe, called The Chilling Thrilling Sounds of the Haunted House. And this thing has, you know, it's an LP. It's a 33 and a third LP, so it's both sides. And each track has something. There was a woman telling a story, and there's some cats being thrown into the fire or something, and all this weird stuff on there. And there is one track where it's the sound of the wind and all that kind of stuff, and pretty creepy. And my job was to make sure that track, I'd sit there. You talk about innovation. I'd sit upstairs next to what we called the hi-fi at the time, and my dad had taken the speakers from the hi-fi and stuck them in the air return vents for the furnace so the sound would go down into the basement. So whatever was on that record, people would hear as they're walking through. And so we had to choreograph it. So I would just drop the needle over and over and over again on this track. It took me years to find that LP, even longer to figure out how to transfer it from LP to digital, I'm here to tell you. It really stretched all my production abilities to figure that stuff out. But it was kind of, it was cool back then. So when I heard it again, much like music, right? When you hear a certain song, it takes you back to a certain event in your life or time or people or experience. And when I hear that, all I can see is my 10 or 11 year old self sitting there with like a glass of bug juice and a cookie, and over and over again, just dropping the needle, and just for hours. I thought it was the best thing in the world, and I still do. So I thought I'd do something a little different this Halloween broadcast. Usually, I talk about my dad and how cool that was and how much fun it was and all the pieces that go into it as I can remember. It's just a special time. I'm so fortunate to have been part of that to a greater or lesser degree, meaning, you know, I never was the guy who wanted to be an architect of haunted houses. That's my dad's job. But to watch him do something that he loves so much and couldn't wait to do, and watch everybody come together and then watch all the people get involved and people participate, and then people go through and just get this. They knew they're going to get this shit scared out, and they went anyway. And the other part was they'd always have this Halloween party after that was all done for the adults. You know, there was mostly a lot of kids came through. We had adults too, but there was like an actual Halloween party. So the final night, people go through, and instead of leaving the house, they would come through in costume and just stay there. And of course, you know, I'd be going to bed after that or whatever. Or if I was even a teenager, I don't want to hang out with these people. So it was always interesting to me the next morning to see the remnants of the party from the night before, the stuff that was left over and parts of a costume. And even that had really some sort of significance to me, that these people had such a great time, and you know, they took the time to get dressed up, and it was the little shop of horrors, but it was a hell of a lot of fun for people. And I actually ran into a friend of mine the other day who remembers all that, and he was saying, "Well, weren't those parties the greatest thing?" Yeah, they were pretty cool. So I've always recap on Halloween a little bit of that, and it makes me feel good. I got my dad's picture right here. I in the off season from radio, or when winter comes and I'm not as busy with projects, I always take to building models. It's a way for me to not think about having to write anything or doing any radio production. It's something very different. And so one of the models I have on tap already, I've already bought, is the Bela Lugosi Aurora model from 1963. It's like a big deal. So I'm looking forward to digging into that at some point. But to wrap all this up, I thought I would do something different. And I started to think about scary things, you know, things that have really unnerved me over time. And outside of like sitting to watch Night of the Living Dead with my buddy Vinnie Connor at the drive-in theater in 1968 at the age of 10 and literally getting the shit scared out of us, I started thinking about how writing can do that. You know, you got to be a really, really good writer to be able to put words together that make people feel fear. And I was sitting here thinking, well, what could I do that might be a little different for this Halloween? And I remembered in high school that I had to read The Telltale Heart by Edgar Allan Poe. And it's not very long, but I'm sitting in class and going, this is some scary shit right here. So I have not put eyes on this since probably 1975. And I started doing a little practice run, because when I'm doing this show, I try to limit editing as much as possible, make it flow as best I can. And I started reading it about 5 o'clock this morning, with the lights out. I mean, I have a light on in the studio, but it's dark outside. I had to wait till it got lighter out. I'm like, this is still scary to me. And there was something about the way that Poe tells the story and relates this story, this short story, that if I could put words together like this, I guess that's why he's Edgar Allan Poe and I'm not. So I thought I would wrap up this Halloween Eve with The Telltale Heart from Edgar Allan Poe, and in memory of my dad, who just loved to scare the shit out of people whenever he could. True. nervous, very, very dreadfully nervous I had been and am. But why will you say that I am mad? The disease had sharpened my senses, not destroyed, not dulled them. Above all was the sense of hearing acute. I heard all things in the heaven and in the earth. I heard many things in hell. How then am I mad? Hearken, and observe now healthily how calmly I can tell you the whole story. It is impossible to say how first the idea entered my brain, but once conceived, it haunted me day and night. Objections, there were none. Passion, there was none. I loved the old man. He had never wronged me. He had never given me insult. For his gold, I had no desire. I think it was his eye. Yes, yes, it was this. One of his eyes resembled that of a vulture, a pale blue eye with a film over it. Whenever it fell upon me, my blood ran cold, and so by degrees, very gradually, I made my mind up to take the life of the old man and thus rid myself of that eye forever. Now this is the point. You fancy me mad. Mad men know nothing, but you should have seen me. You should have seen how wisely I proceeded, with what great caution I could muster, with what great foresight, with what dissimulation I went to work. I was never kinder to the old man than during the whole week before I killed him, and every night about midnight I turned the latch of his door and opened it oh so gently, oh so quietly, and then, when I had made an opening sufficient for my head, I put a darkened lantern in, all closed, closed, so that no light shone out, and then I thrust my head in. Oh, you would have laughed to see how cunningly I thrust it in. I moved it slowly, very, very slowly, so that I might not disturb the old man's sleep. It took me an hour to place my whole head within the opening so far that I could see him as he lay upon his bed. Ha! Would a madman have been so wise as this? And then, when my head was well in the room, I undid the lantern cautiously, oh, so cautiously, cautiously, for the hinges creaked. I undid it just so much that a single thin ray fell upon that vulture eye. And this I did for 7 long nights, every night just at midnight. But I found the eye always closed. And so it was impossible to do the work, for it was not the old man who vexed me, but his evil eye. And every morning, when the day broke, I went boldly into the chamber and spoke courageously to him, calling him by name in a hearty tone, and inquiring how he had passed the night. So you see, he would have been a profound old man, indeed, to suspect that every night, just at 12, I looked upon him while he slept. Upon the 8th night, I was more than unusually cautious in opening the door. A watch's minute hand moves more quickly than mine did. Never before that night had I felt the extent of my own powers, of my true sanctity. I could scarcely contain my feelings of triumph. To think that there I was, opening the door, little by little, and he had not even to dream of my secret deeds or thoughts. I fairly chuckled at the idea, and perhaps he heard me, for he moved on the bed suddenly as if startled. Now you may think that I drew back, but no. His room was black as pitch with the thick darkness, for the shutters were closed and fastened through fear of robbers, of course. And so I knew that he could not see the opening of the door, and I kept pushing on it steadily, oh so steadily. I had my head in and was about to open the lantern when my thumb slipped on the tin fastening, and the old man sprang up in the bed crying out, "Who's there?" I kept quite still and said nothing. For a whole hour, I did not move a single muscle, and in the meantime, I did not hear him lie down. He was still sitting up in the bed, listening, just as I have done, night after night after night, hearkening to the death watches in the wall. Presently, I heard a slight groan, and I knew it was the groan of mortal terror. It was not the groan of pain or grief. Oh, no! It was the low, stifled sound that arises from the bottom of the soul when overcharged with awe and fear. I knew the sound well. Many a night, just at midnight, when all the world slept, it has welled up from my own bosom, deepening with its dreadful echo the terrors that distracted me. I say, I know it well. I knew what the old man felt, and I pitied him, although I chuckled at heart. I knew that he had been lying awake ever since that first slight noise when he had turned into the bed. His fears, have been ever since growing upon him. He'd been trying to fancy them causeless, but could not. He'd been saying to himself, "It is nothing but the wind in the chimney. It is only a mouse crossing the floor," or, "It is merely a cricket which has made a single chirp." Yes, he's been trying to comfort himself with all these suppositions, but he had found them all in vain, because death, in approaching him, had stalked with its black shadow before him and enveloped the victim. And it was the mournful influence of the unperceived shadow that caused him to feel, although he never saw or heard it, to feel the presence of my head within the room. When I had waited a long time, a very long time, and very patiently without hearing him lie down, I resolved to open a little, a very, very little crevice in the lantern. So I opened it. You cannot imagine how stealthily, stealthily, until at length a single dim ray, like the thread of the spider, shot from the crevice and fell upon that vulture eye. It was open. It was wide, wide open. And I grew furious as I gazed upon it. I saw it with perfect distinctness, all in a dull blue, with a hideous veil over it that chilled the very marrow in my bones. But I could see nothing else of the old man's face or persona, for I had directed the ray, as if by instinct, precisely on the damned spot. And now, have I not told you what you mistake for madness is but over-acuteness of the senses? Now I say, there came to my ears a low, dull, quick sound, such as a watch makes when enveloped in cotton. I knew that sound well, too. It was the beating of the old man's heart. It increased my fury, as the beating of a drum stimulates the soldier into courage. But even yet, I refrained and kept still. I scarcely breathed. I held the lantern motionless. I tried how steadily I could maintain the ray upon the eye. Meantime, the hellish tattoo of the heart increased. It grew quicker and quicker and louder every instant. The old man's terror must have been extreme. It grew louder, I say, louder every moment. Do you mark me well? I have told you that I am nervous, so I am. And now, at the dead hour of night, amid the dreadful silence of that old house, so strange a noise as this excited me to an uncontrollable terror. Yet for some minutes longer I refrained and stood still. But the beating grew louder and louder. I thought the heart must burst, and now a new anxiety seized me. The sound would surely be heard by a neighbor. The old man's hour had come, nonetheless. With a loud yell, I threw open the lantern and leaped into the room. He shrieked once, but only once. In an instant I dragged him to the floor and pulled the heavy bed over him. I then smiled gaily to find the deed so far done. But for many minutes, the heartbeat went on with a muffled sound. This, however, did not vex me. It would not be heard through the wall, and at length it finally ceased. The old man was dead. I removed the bed and examined the corpse. Yes, he was stone, stone dead. I placed my hand upon the heart and held it there many minutes. There was no pulsation. He was stone dead. His eye would trouble me no more. If you still think me mad, you will think so no longer when I describe the wise precautions I took for the concealment of the body. The night waned, and I worked hastily but in silence. First of all, I dismembered the corpse. I cut off the head and the arms and the legs. I then took up three planks from the floor of the chamber and deposited all between the scantlings. I then replaced the board so cleverly, so cunningly, that no human eye, not even his, could have detected anything wrong. There was nothing to wash out, no stain of any kind, no blood spot whatsoever. I had been too wary for that. A tub had caught all. When I had made an end to these labors, it was 4 o'clock, still dark as midnight. As the bell sounded the hour, there came a knocking at the street door. I went down to open it with a light heart. There entered three men who introduced themselves with perfect clarity as officers of the police. A shriek had been heard by a neighbor during the night. Suspicion of foul play had been aroused. The information had been lodged at the police office, and they had been dispatched to search the premises. I smiled, for what did I have to fear? I bade the gentlemen welcome. The shriek, I said, was my own in a dream. The old man, I mentioned, was absent in the country. I took my visitors all over the house. I bade them search well, I led them at length to his chamber. I showed them his treasures, secure, undisturbed. In the enthusiasm of my confidence, I actually brought chairs into the room and desired them here to rest from their fatigues, while I myself, in the wild audacity of my perfect triumph, placed my own seat upon the very spot beneath which reposed the corpse of my victim. The officers, of course, were satisfied. My manner had convinced them. I was singularly at ease. They sat, and while I answered cheerily, they chatted of familiar things. But ere long gone, I felt myself getting pale and started to wish them gone. My head began to ache, and I fancied a ringing in my ears, but they still sat and chatted. The ringing became more distinct. It continued and became even more distinct. I talked more freely to get rid of the feeling, but it continued and gained a definiteness, until at last I found the noise was not within my ears. There is no doubt I now grew very pale, but I talked with more fluently and with a heightened voice, and yet the sound increased, and what could I do? It was a low, dull, quick sound, much sound as a watch makes when enveloped in cotton. I gasped for breath, and yet the officers heard it not. I talked more quickly and more vehemently, but the noise steadily increased. I arose and argued about trifles in a high key and with violent gestures, but the noise steadily increased. Why would they not be gone? I paced the floor to and fro with heavy strides, as if excited by fury and the observations of the men, but the noise steadily increased. Oh God, what could I do? I foamed, I raved, I swore. I swung the chair upon which I had been sitting and grated it upon the boards, but the noise arose over all and continually increased and grew louder and louder and louder. And still the men chatted pleasantly and smiled. Was it possible they heard not? Almighty God, no, no, they heard it. They must have heard it. They suspected. They knew. They were making a mockery of my horror. This I thought, and this I think. But anything was better than this agony. Anything was more tolerable than this terror. I could bear these hypocritical smiles no longer. I felt I must scream or die. And now, again, hark, louder, 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 louder. Villains, I shrieked. Dissemble no more. I admit the deed. Tear up the planks. Here, here, here is the beating of his hideous heart. Edgar Allan Poe, January 1843. I first read that in high school, as I mentioned, a long time ago, and literally, I have not read those words since then. And I'm sitting here in my studio recounting that. Now, I didn't read it in class out loud like that. But literally, right as I get towards the end of that, the hair on my legs is standing straight out. It's like, this guy wrote this how long ago? 178 years ago, something like that. The fact that he wrote this, and he's the only one that knows what it means. You can go online and dig as deep as you want on this, and nobody really knows where this came from in him, what prompted this story. But if you can write this and 178 years later, I'm sitting here sharing it, and the hair of my leg stands up, I think he did a pretty good job, whatever that's all about. It's a grisly, macabre, dark thing. And yet his words, in my opinion, have so much lightness to them. There's just a few writers that I am enamored with over time. You know, Poe is one, John Steinbeck, of course, sometimes Hemingway. There's just very few. And all of them have found a way to take something like this, like maybe only in his own mind. Maybe there was something, a story he read in the paper back then that prompted us. But they're able to take something and create it from nothing. So they're starting with this blank slate, and there's nothing there. And pretty soon you have this poem, which is stands the test of time. So thanks so much for indulging me in this once a year outing into just a wonderful, wonderful time in my life, and my dad, who I miss so much. It truly was one of those rare gifts in life when you get to be around something so special like that. You know, my dad was a great guy, the banker, always wanted to be an architect, and he uses architectural skills, I think, to build the haunted house every year. He did it for 20 years, and I think the highlight for him was at one time, there was an article done in the Chicago Tribune. This has got to be, I don't know, 78, 77, 78, 79, somewhere in that time frame. Tribune did an article on local haunted houses. Now, again, there was no corporate haunted houses back then. Amling's Flowerland, up like in Norridge or Des Plaines, a suburb of Chicago, had a really good one. And they mentioned my dad's basement, our house. In the, I don't know where that article's at either, but he made the big time then. I mean, he brought 25 copies of the paper just to get that article. And it mentioned, you know, the haunted house on Berto Avenue and this guy who was a banker by day and becomes Christopher Lee / Bela Lugosi / Nosferatu for 2 weeks out of the year at night. And it was just a great, great time. So thanks so much for listening once again. Enjoy Halloween. Until next time, safe travels. Adios.
You are a bold and courageous person, afraid of nothing. High on a hilltop near your home, there stands a dilapidated old mansion. Some say the place is haunted, but you don't believe in such myths. One dark and stormy night, a light appears in the topmost window in the tower of the old house. You decide to investigate, and you never return.